We have two cases on our 10:30 docket. We welcome everybody here. The first case is Heard versus Heard, and counsel have checked in. If the clerk will please announce counsel who will be arguing today. All right, Mr. Bragg.
Madam Chief Justice, Your Honors, Counsel, good morning. May it please the Court, there are four issues on appeal in this matter. I believe my time would best be spent discussing the second issue as outlined in my brief. That is, did the trial court err in permanently enjoining Mr. Heard from entering onto his separate real property? As the Court well knows, trial court cannot divest a spouse of his or her separate real property. Such a divestiture is in violation of the state constitution and the family code. Pursuant to the decree entered by the trial court, Mr. Heard was permanently enjoined from entering onto the premise of the residence located on 8220 Holiday Road, Lantana, Texas, 76226, including both the interior of the residence and the surrounding property of the residence without the knowledge or consent of Mrs. Heard. Now, there is no issue as to whether or not this property is separate. Both parties agreed on the record, and the court confirmed it via the final decree entered in this matter. Now, it's well-settled law in the state of Texas that a permanent injunction continues in effect until modified or dissolved because of changed conditions, or until it expires by its own terms on the happening of contingencies expressly designated and provided for.
If this court were to reform that, as appellee seems to acknowledge is appropriate, to expire upon the first of which contingency that it is abandoned or the children are no longer minors, doesn't seem like that's in dispute. So if we were to do that, then where does your argument go?
That's actually precisely what we're requesting the court to do, because you're correct. Currently, the appellee has a present possessory interest in the property. Our client, the way the decree is written right now, even if her present possessory interest ceases, he's enjoined from ever possessing the property. So what we're requesting is to reform the decree to ensure that, as currently written, is a permanent injunction, ceases when her present possessory interest terminates, which is the earlier of when she's not a resident of the property or when the children of the marriage are otherwise emancipated. And that's precisely what we're requesting the court do today. Otherwise, he is completely divested in any possessory interest whatsoever in the property.
The language that's in the judgment under the title that's called present possessory interest, it's on page 34 or 37. Is that language what you're thinking should be the language used if the court chooses to modify the length of the injunction? In other words, you said a little different about the children. It says here that when they reach the age of 18 or graduate from high school, whichever occurs earlier, or both disabilities are otherwise removed. That language, 1, 2, 3, is that what you think is appropriate for the limitation on the duration of the injunction?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that's appropriate.
All right, thank you.
With that said, I think the court understands our position on that. I'd like to move briefly to the third issue on appeal, which is attorney's fees. And the issue is, did the trial court err in awarding a judgment for attorney's fees and costs against Mr. Heard when no evidence as to the reasonableness and necessity of such an award is present in the record? Now, appellee has argued and will argue that appellant Mr. Heard has waived this issue and has failed to preserve it with the trial court. This court is well aware of Texas Rule of Appellate Procedure, Rule 33.1D, which allows legal and factual sufficiency arguments to be brought on appeal for the first time. And this is precisely what we're doing. The court has surely reviewed the record. The record is completely void of any fact that relates to the reasonableness and necessity of attorney's fee awarded. Now, Hardin v. Hardin out of the 14th Court of Appeals states that to support reasonable and necessary attorney's fees, testimony should be provided related to the hours spent on the matter, the nature of preparation on the matter, complexity of the case, experience of the attorneys on the case, and the hourly rate of those attorneys. Now, surely the court has looked at the record, and in appellant's brief, we cite to the one page in the reporter's record that mentions attorney's fees. No testimony or evidence whatsoever was provided on any of those elements. Zero. There is a complete absence of any of these vital facts. Accordingly, the trial court abused its discretion in awarding attorney's fees because the evidence before it was legally insufficient. It wasn't there. Therefore, the judgment should be reversed and rendered that appellee take nothing. And the reason I say we take nothing is because we could have requested a judgment on attorney's fees at trial, essentially a directed verdict on that issue, because no evidence was provided whatsoever by appellee at the trial court supporting these attorney's fees.
Rattle, there, I pulled the record and read the parts of the reporter's record you cited in your brief, and I also found petitioner's exhibit number 10.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I found that to be at least a statement as to the attorney's fees that were, in terms of what it says, total fees incurred. It doesn't say anything about reasonability in that exhibit, but when you say there's a total lack, I mean, there is, in fact, this exhibit number 10, there's just no testimony to support it's being reasonable.
Fair enough, Your Honor. That is correct. Exhibit number 10 is a conclusory exhibit that appellee testified to at trial, stated, these are the fees I believe I've incurred. There was no testimony as to the reasonableness or necessity. There is no testimony as to the Hardin v. Hardin elements that are required. There is no testimony by counsel of appellee at trial. That's our issue, Your Honor. And again, this can be brought for the first time on appeal pursuant to 33.1D of the Texas Rules of Appellate Procedure. And actually, the Office of Attorney General of Texas versus Burton out of the Supreme Court has stated precisely this, that the whole purpose of Rule 33.1D is to allow a legal or factual insufficiency argument to be brought on appeal for the first time. With that, Your Honor, I believe, should the court not have any further questions, I believe the remaining issues are adequately addressed in the briefing, and I would like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Gray. Ms. Dion.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court, my name is Erin Dion. I'm here today on behalf of Christy Hurd, the appellee in this case. As stated by Mr. Bragg, this is a case that arises out of a divorce out of the 431st District Court. The final decree was entered on October 1st of 2012. Mr. Hurd has raised four issues on appeal: whether the property division constitutes an abuse of discretion, whether the injunction granted to Mrs. Hurd was improper, whether the attorney's fees award in favor of Mrs. Hurd was appropriate, and whether the trial court improperly failed to issue findings of fact and conclusions of law regarding child support. I will also skip first to the issue of the injunction granted in favor of Mrs. Hurd pertaining to the real property. As stated by Mr. Bragg, there is no disagreement about the fact that this property is the separate property, one half belonging to Mrs. Hurd and one half belonging to Mr. Hurd. I think it's clear from the record and the language in the decree that the court intended to preserve Mrs. Hurd's present possessory interest in the property, and so that injunction should be modified to exist so long as that present possessory interest in the property is active. I believe, pursuant to the Vanerson case, this court has the authority to modify that without remanding it to the trial court. As to the issue of attorney's fees, the appellant has pled only a legal insufficiency as to that award. It's well settled under Texas law that a party who attempts to overcome an adverse finding using a legal sufficiency challenge must surmount two hurdles, the first being that the record must be examined for evidence to support the finding while ignoring all evidence to the contrary. As discussed earlier this morning, there is the petitioner's Exhibit 10, which does outline the amount of attorney's fees requested by Mrs. Hurd, and she also testified as to her request in that regard. So I don't believe that Mr. Hurd can overcome that first hurdle of the legal sufficiency challenge. The second hurdle of the legal sufficiency challenge is that if there is no evidence to support the finding, then the entire record must be examined to see if the contrary proposition is established as a matter of law. Again, because of Petitioner's Exhibit 10, I don't think the matter is established conclusively as a matter of law, and therefore I think the legal sufficiency challenge must fail, and the attorney's fees award should be
advised. Where is there any evidence that those attorney's fees were reasonable or necessary?
There was no testimony on my part, Your Honor, but there was the Petitioner's Exhibit 10, which was admitted into evidence without any objection.
Those are just numbers. I mean, those don't establish the basis for the award of attorney's fees. If that were the case, anybody could introduce an exhibit that says, you know, my attorney's fees were $1 million, and that would be good enough.
Correct, Your Honor, but I think in this case, because of the fact that Mr. Hurd did not object to the introduction of that evidence or enter any evidence to that was contrary to that exhibit, in addition, today he's only brought a legal sufficiency challenge, and I don't think he's met his burden to prove that that evidence is legally insufficient.
Leon, how would you analyze the impact, if any at all, on Petitioner's Exhibit 18 on the question of attorney's fees? In other words, on Exhibit 18, this was a summary of Petitioner's requested relief?
Yes, sir.
And there was a part of that requested relief that asked for attorney's fees in the amount of $18,568.98, and then another portion that says that was as outlined in Exhibit 10, and then only an alternative, a judgment for attorney's fees in the amount of $12,913.24.
Yes.
I'm trying to understand the difference, and if there's two places where attorney's fees are mentioned in the record, and it's on Exhibits 10 and Exhibit 18, what's the $12,000, $900 fee, $900 fee?
Your Honor, I believe if you look back at Exhibit 10, there were two alternative requests for relief as to attorney's fees. Mr. Hurd did, during the course of the litigation, refuse to participate in mediation. So there was an alternative request from the trial court to award attorney's fees that had incurred only since the date he refused to participate in mediation.
So the $12,19 is just fees incurred after the referral to mediation?
That's correct. The $18,000 would have been the entirety of the case. The $12,000 would have been since Mr. Hurd.
Thank you very much.
Finally, Your Honor, I would like to address the issue of the child support findings. Mr. Hurd has contended that the court improperly failed to issue findings of fact and conclusions of law with regard to the setting of child support. The applicable statute in this case is Texas Family Code 154.130. If you read through Section B, it's my contention that the only element missing from the required findings in 154.130B is number two, the net resources of the obligee per month. It would have been impossible for the court to make a finding in that regard. There was no evidence admitted during the trial as to Mrs. Hurd's monthly net income. I would argue that the remaining elements are contained within the divorce decree. And that is on page 16, the section statement on guidelines. we're not contending at this point that the findings of fact were timely issued, because I think it's clear that they were not. Our argument today is that the court substantially complied with the requirements by issuing the findings contained on page 16 in the final decree of divorce, which was available to Mr. Hurd before his appeal was filed. Rule 44.1 of the Texas Rules of Appellate Procedure require Mr. Hurd to show that he was harmed by the court's failure to issue those findings of fact and conclusions of law. He has not stated in his brief that he was harmed. I don't believe there's been any showing of harm. And as a result, because of the court's substantial compliance with the Texas Family Code and the fact that Mr. Hurd has demonstrated no harm as to that issue, I believe that that must be affirmed.
Ms. Pham, what is the source and evidence in the record for the $48,000 annually that's found on page 16? That's called the earning potential of Mr. Hurd.
Yes, sir. There was evidence in the record that Mr. Hurd had previously held jobs that earned him $70,000 per year.
I read that, but I just didn't see anything about $48,000.
I don't know what exhibit it was. I believe that there was an exhibit entered as to his resume, perhaps. There was a fourth job on that resume that listed his income as $48,000.
Okay, thank you.
And if there are no further questions, on behalf of the appellee, Christy Hurd, we would respectfully request that the court affirm this case in all matters. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dion. Mr. Bragg, rebuttal.
Unless your honors have any further questions, I believe I'm going to waive rebuttal.
All right. We appreciate your submissions today, your arguments, and of course your briefing as well. Your case is submitted and you all are now excused. We will proceed on to the next case on our docket, which is Ortiz versus Plano Independent School District.